From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, finding the human side of Adolf Hitler. Downfall is a controversial new German film depicting Hitler and his henchmen grinding through the final days of the Third Reich in Hitler's underground bunker. The film has been criticized for showing a Hitler who dotes over children and pets his dog as the Nazi state crumbles around him. Today we talk with actor Bruno Ganz about inhabiting the character of one of history's greatest criminals. And we meet the film's director, Oliver Hirschbiegel. Downfall was nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Film. And one of the most colorful players ever to put on a baseball uniform, Bill Lee. Left-handed pitcher earned the nickname the Spaceman when he pitched for the Red Sox and the Expos in the 70s and 80s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're used to seeing Nazis depicted in film as pitiless monsters, but are we ready to see them as human beings committing monstrous acts? That's a question posed by the new German film Downfall, which presents a detailed and historically accurate account of the last 12 days of the Third Reich as experienced in Hitler's underground bunker. A half a million Germans saw Downfall in its first 5 days, and it earned an Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Film. The film has stirred controversy because it depicts Adolf Hitler and other Nazi leaders, Joseph Goebbels and Heinrich Himmler among them, as people with families and feelings. The Hitler in Downfall does indulge in rants of self-pity and paranoia, but he also shows kindness towards his aides, secretaries, and his dog, Blondie. Our guests today are the film's director, Oliver Hirschbiegel, who has directed in film and German television, and veteran actor Bruno Ganz, who portrays Hitler. Ganz was born in Switzerland, but has lived in Berlin for much of his life, and he's a familiar figure in German cinema. He starred in Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire and has appeared in several American movies, including The Boys from Brazil and the remake of The Manchurian Candidate. To prepare for his role, Ganz immersed himself in first-hand descriptions of Hitler. He read books and studied archival film and listened to recordings of his voice. Political leaders are known for having ways of being persuasive to people. Some of them inspire their followers. Some of them bully. Some of them joke. As you looked at these materials from those who had firsthand experience with Adolf Hitler, what was his style one-on-one? We all picture him as a ranting speechmaker, but what was he like one-on-one? What did you learn?
I learned that all of them are saying that he was quite a gentle male, that he could be generous, that he treated them well, that he was... And then they mention, all of them say that he was yelling, screaming, and terribly angry sometimes. They couldn't figure out why, but they accepted this because he was a big shot, and so, you know. But I was really surprised by it was rather warm feelings they had. What they wrote and said about him was after 45, which is important because they didn't know the entire. They didn't know really what he did to the. To the genocide side of what I mean, what he did to the Jews was really known after the war. So even then, they said he could be a very gentle man, and this was this surprised me. But I, from the very beginning, I thought the really interesting point is how did he come in power? Why was he? Supported, and I would dare to say loved, by a lot of German people. And then you should try to show that the arrest or even ruins of what he once represented is still present, even in a very deranged way. That was my goal.
Hitler's biographer Ian Kershaw remarked that you, Bruno Ganz, had Hitler's voice in this film down to perfection. He described it as chillingly authentic. Let's just listen to a little bit of you in this film portraying Adolf Hitler.
Himmler. Unter euch ausgerechnet Himmler. Der treueste der Treue. Das ist der schlimmste Verrat von allen. Göring, ja. Der war korrupt, immer schon. Speer, ja. Ein wildfremder, unberechenbarer Künstler. All die anderen, ja. Aber Himmler.
That was Bruno Ganz in the film Downfall, in which he portrays Adolf Hitler. Bruno Ganz, how did you find Hitler's voice? How did you duplicate it?
We in Europe, we have, let's say, my generation still, we remember his speeches, which was frightening at that. But you are a kid when I heard him or listened to his, even in Switzerland where I was brought up. And you so remember really this kind of screaming, and it's so, it was frightening. That's what we remember. But then when I got that tape, that that you can hear him talk to a Finnish diplomat. It was secretly recorded, and he's completely relaxed. And he sounds so, I mean, he is talking about the usual stuff, about his army on the Russian front, which it was in 42, and he started to understand that this adventure in Russia maybe would go wrong. And so he's talking about his army would be a rather summer army and not prepared for winter, and summer army and winter army and this kind of distinction. You can hear him completely relaxed. And I thought that's a good example for the bunker, because in the last days, and talking to people very close to him, like Eva Braun, he will not be yelling at her, and I could clearly hear the mixture between his Austrian dialect and this kind of militarized real correct German, and he managed to mix this too, because he came from Austria and he had a quite heavy accent. He managed to learn this the official German, but underneath you can still hear where he is from, and this is for German speaking people interesting. I always wondered what kind of language he used, and so I this was one of my training. The other was the Parkinson disease. I went to hospitals and watched people with that disease, and so I learned this kind of trembling, shaking hand, and whatsoever.
Hitler had Parkinson. You felt that's something you had to learn about, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. What did that add to the performance, do you think?
Well, it was a technical difficulty. When I'm using the term technical, I mean this is a really active language, or my language. I mean, you had to keep shaking or trembling the left hand, while you are screaming at someone and you are emotionally completely, really, you get furious and you are engaged and you're completely concentrated on your emotions, and it shouldn't stop that your hand keeps trembling, and that's just that's some problem sometimes for an actor.
Yeah, a lot of actors, when they're shooting a movie for a period of time, bring the part home with them. At least some essential core of the character they are playing stays with them in their off hours. And I wonder if you found that was true while you were shooting this film, and if it bothered you.
No, but I feared it, so I thought I got to construct it. I don't know how shall I explain this? Kind of a security wall or something, so that I would be able really to go into it at the studio in the shooting hours, and once I leave the studio, I could completely lose him and turn away and be myself and go back to a hotel and have dinner or not, and just not to care anymore about Hitler. That's what I managed, but I, you know, now 5 months later, I feel that I didn't. It's not. there's still some shadow.
Our guests are Bruno Ganz. He is the actor who played Adolf Hitler in Downfall, the new film about the closing days of the Third Reich in Adolf Hitler's underground bunker. Also with us is Oliver Hirschbiegel, who is the director of the film. Oliver Hirschbiegel, you were born in Germany in 1957. You've seen the German people come to terms with the Nazi experience over the years. And I'm wondering, I mean, this is a big question, but where do you think the German national consciousness is today with the Nazi experience? And how has that affected the way you would want to portray or the kind of artistic picture of Hitler that you wanted to present?
See, I don't think there hasn't been, and there will never be a coming to terms with that part of our history. That to me sounds like as if there that there is a chance to find peace, you know? And I do not think so. I think even though I was born after the war, and there are my children and the children of my children will certainly not be guilty, but the Germans will, for the next hundreds of years, have to live with the responsibility. There is no coming to terms with the fact that we stand for the worst crime in the history of human mankind. That's the wrong. I think is a wrong idea. We, especially the younger generation, myself, we have always just been lectured about this part of our history, and I always found that ridiculous. Firstly, I do not want to be lectured about things. I want to be able to ask questions and get sufficient answers. And then it is not enough to describe horror. I always had the feeling that just only describing it kind of diminishes the horror. I think we really have to understand that the blood of the people who were responsible for this is still in our veins, and we really have to do research. What is it in the German soul? What is it in the German history that made this possible in this particular moment? And I think that's for years to come. We will have to work on this.
Director Oliver Hirschbiegel, also with us actor Bruno Ganz, who portrayed Hitler in the new German film Downfall. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with actor Bruno Ganz and director Oliver Hirschbiegel about the new German film Downfall. You wanted to make this film as historically accurate as possible, and so you did a lot of research. Tell us, first of all, about the bunker. I mean, it's this cavernous, multi-corridored place in the film. Tell us a little bit about it and how you wanted to depict it.
Well, I had watched all the other films, and all the directors had taken their freedom and had used this bunker situation for their purposes, right? The color and the shape and all that. And I thought that, and I still believe so, there is no messing around with the Third Reich. I think you have to take on this subject very serious. So it was only logic for me to tell my production designer that I wanted this bunker to be constructed exactly in the same way that it originally was, following the floor plan. And we were lucky enough to get the original floor plan. And what you see in the film is, to the centimeter, or to the inch, as you say here in this country, exact what it was like.
What was remarkable about the bunker to you?
Well, it's considering the size of the horror the Third Reich created, the bunker situation there, it was nearly funny. It was this whole system was reduced to a dirty little kind of community kitchen or something like that.
Wow.
Furniture was great, yeah.
What was that?
It was a mix, you know. It was like these rooms made by concrete, and then they just took down some of that furniture from the Reichschancellery, which was way too big because it was designed for the Reichschancellery, which was a huge building, and it was odd. It must have been odd then, and it was very odd to walk around in my own set. It was surprising. And, you know, I had an advisor at hand, the Baron Loringhofen. He was the assistant of General Krebs, and he's 92 now. And he could, like, exactly describe which furniture was standing. He could tell us all the details and could tell us things that were not quite right. And it was amazing to see him walk around there, because he just said, yes, this is how it looked like. This is how it was.
One of the most disturbing subplots or scenes in this is we see Joseph Goebbels and his wife Magda, and his wife, without necessarily giving away a part of the story everyone might know, has the notion that she should kill all of her children because she does not want them to live in a world that does not have national socialism. And I think what's interesting about the scene as she approaches this resolution of hers to murder her own children is an absence of ambivalence about it, I mean, or regret. I mean, she seems completely determined. In fact, she weeps hardest for Hitler, and when she falls at his knees and begs him to keep leading. Do you think a woman could approach killing her own children without shedding a tear, as she does in this film?
Well, we know that after she had killed her children, she went back stone-faced, sat down, and laid out a card game, solitaire, and that her tears were streaming, but that she did not show any emotion aside from that. That seems logic to me, because whenever I watch this documentary footage, watching her, she always appeared as a very cold person in a way. Of course, she deals with the killing in a loving way, but to me, she always appears rather like a machine. And then to my own surprise, I watched Goebbels himself. I mean, this is one of the meanest characters you find in history. And you watch this man, and you know this man loves his children. He really cares for them. You see him as he plays for them, and it's obvious he doesn't do it for the news. It's something, as a director, I can judge that was real. And that's very unsettling to see that. And, of course, it was very helpful, too.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Oliver Hirschbiegel. He is the director of the film Downfall, which depicts the closing days of the Third Reich as seen in Hitler's underground bunker. Also with us, Bruno Ganz, who plays Adolf Hitler in the film. About a year ago, we interviewed the director Bronwyn Hughes, who'd made a film in South Africa called Stander. And in that film, there was a scene in which she reconstructed a deadly confrontation from the apartheid area between white South African police and demonstrators in a black township. And one of the things she said was that it was very painful for the South African actors and the extras to depict this traumatic part of their relatively recent history. And I'm wondering whether, as those of you worked in this claustrophobic reconstruction of Hitler's bunker, whether it was hard for any of the German actors and crew to relive this painful part of German history.
Well, now it's the actor answering. I mean, I wouldn't say painful, but German actors do not like to do this. And once they do it because they, I don't know, money or because just they need work or something, it's a very ironical way they approach. And it's a lot of joking, and they do this Hitler salute, and it's embarrassing. And so they try to come with jokes. But I didn't like that very much because I couldn't afford that for my Hitler interpretation, so I tried to stop them. And we, so after, well, I don't know, 10 days or so, we had a very calm and was quiet, and we were concentrated on what we had to do, and we got somehow used to enter in early in the morning this bunker and to leave it at night and being as extras somehow close to the leading Nazi figures. This was part of the job. And I felt that my colleagues, I am not born in I'm considered as a German actor, but so maybe for me it's easier, or was
right.
Easier.
But you were born in Switzerland, but lived many years in Berlin, right?
Yeah, I feel very close to Germany, and I would not be ashamed to be German, not at all. But, you know, my parents or grandparents had not to deal with or I had never to ask them, what did you do? What did you do at that time? Because they lived in Switzerland, and so they were not involved, which made it maybe easier for me.
Oliver, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, one must be aware that these symbols they were using, the swastika, these SS runes, the uniforms, all the other symbols, they have a very strong power still, a frightening power. So I would not call it painful, but very unpleasant, and you have to deal with it day in, day out, month for month for month. For me, it never ended because I had to cut the film as well. What was really painful was the shoot of the sedating and killing of the children. That was really painful. That was the most terrible shooting days I ever had, and that was painful for the actors as well. And of course, it was not for the children, because I had explained to them what we were setting out to do. I'd explained that story. I told them that was so unbelievable that children could be killed by their own parents, that we had to restage it now to make sure that would never happen again. They went with that, and they were happy, gay, and outspoken. They took it as a cool game to play, while all the adults were standing by, and you know, we're fighting tears, right?
Right.
I'm a father of two children. Corinna has three children. It's inconceivable.
But these were nice kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Very talented, right, too.
Yeah. Right.
Director Oliver Hirschbiegel and actor Bruno Ganz, who portrays Hitler in the new German film Downfall. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delacorte, publisher of Alternative Atlanta, a novel about a young man coming to terms with love, relationships, and familial obligations, by Marshall Boswell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview about the making of the German film Downfall, which depicts the end of the Third Reich in Hitler's underground bunker. Also, we meet one of baseball's most colorful players, Bill the Spaceman Lee. After leaving the big leagues, he ran for president on the Rhinoceros Party ticket. His new memoir is Have Glove, Will Travel. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guests are actor Bruno Ganz and director Oliver Hirschbiegel. Ganz plays Adolf Hitler in the new German film Downfall, which depicts the end of the Third Reich and Hitler's underground bunker. Hirschbiegel directed the film.
This film has been widely viewed in Germany. It's caused it's earned praise, and it's also stirred some controversy. And I wanted you to address some of the criticisms. One of them, there was, I guess it was Julie Salmon in the New York Times, kind of was struck by the telling detail and the candor of this picture, this portrait of Hitler in his final days. But she said, what does this really tell us? I mean, that in his in his final days in the bunker. He sits, he shakes, he has lunch. But so what? And David Denby of The New Yorker also has a similar take, sort of says that it evokes a picture, but do we really learn anything from it? And what is your reaction to the idea that in seeing these Hitler, the details of his life, we don't learn anything new or meaningful about him and the Nazi experience? Oliver, I guess that is to you.
Well, there are 82,000 books written about Adolf Hitler alone, and none of these books give sufficient answers about this whole complex, especially Adolf Hitler. So a film will never be able to explain all that. There's a lot of knowledge in this film that was not common before we had done it. So I do not really understand that question. Mm-hmm. I read the piece by Dunby, and I was a bit I was a bit sad because I'm a big admirer of The New Yorker, and it for me stands for doing precise research and homework, and the gentleman has not done it. He states things like that I would stage the suicides of these officers as heroic acts.
And just to clarify for our audience, some of the officers in the bunker as it's coming to the end shoot themselves, and David Denby criticizes you as sort of portraying this as if it's a noble act. You're saying it was not at all noble.
Of course not. I think it's cowardice to kill yourself and not face the consequences of your doing. But you must know that was just following the tradition of the Prussian army. It was not an invention of the Nazis. It was a very German thing to do. And who am I to make them kill themselves as cowards? They just did not do it. Mm-hmm. They just took the guns and put it to their heads and pulled the trigger. Now, the concept of this film is that we only show things that we know about. We have accounts and descriptions, and that's what I did. And I did very thorough research.
And I think that the younger generation, people about let's say 20 or so in Germany, that they can learn something about their German history, because you know it's one thing, and I think it's quite abstract to read books about it, and a movie is something very, very physical. And you see these people. Hitler, for instance, he got a face, he got movements, he got a way to speak, and that's something they lack at school. So for them, I'm sure this film will, I mean, if it's this is the question, if you can learn something, I think they really can learn something.
I watched the film with my wife, and when it ended, I mean, I think we both found it riveting. But she said, you know, I'm not sure what the point of view here is. And I wonder if this isn't at the heart of some of the criticism you're getting, because, and we have to say that the film doesn't just depict Hitler in the bunker. There are terrible scenes of the suffering that German civilians are enduring outside as the war continues. But in order to show Hitler as a human being and the other characters as human beings, you inevitably show their point of view, and inevitably some part of the film empathizes with them. And I'm wondering if the problem is that in seeing these characters as human beings, you're simply bringing us close to something that we don't want to, a part of us doesn't want. We don't want to see these people.
Because we know we all have evil in us. That seems to be the frightening point. See, if we talk about the point of view, the point of view is not the point of view of these people. The point of view of the film in wanting to be obviously a film against war. What we see is are perpetrators, basically all bad people. Now, as I do not do a documentary, it's my job as a director to kiss these characters to life as they were. They were human beings. They were fathers, they were sons, and they were just human beings. And that seems to be the upsetting fact in some cases, because We all know that evil can come around with a smiling face and very friendly. And stating that these people were not just evil monsters, but human beings, implies, of course, that this can happen again or might happen again. And I understand that is a frightening thought. But we, as the Germans, we can't let go just by saying this was terrible and we are responsible and this must never happen again, because it's a dead end road.
Yeah.
To say the horror was tremendous is not enough. We have to find out how this was possible. And the only way to do it is by reaching down into the German soul. We have to touch the German soul to come up with answers and questions.
And in addition, I would say that we are artists, which includes that we are curious, and we should be allowed, or even if we are not allowed, we should take risks. And this, in this film, we take the risk of a closer look. And this might be disturbing, and people might not like it, but somehow it's true what we did.
Well, Bruno Gentz, Oliver Hirschbiegel, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Director Oliver Hirschbiegel and actor Bruno Gentz. Their new film about the end of the Third Reich is called Downfall. Coming up, the spaceman of Major League Baseball, Bill Lee. This is Fresh Air. If the game of baseball has produced an odder specimen than Bill Lee, we haven't met him. He was a long-haired left-handed pitcher for the Boston Red Sox and the Montreal Expos in the 70s and 80s. He won 119 games and pitched in the World Series. But he's better known for a host of other achievements and offenses, like admitting to marijuana use as a player, wearing a gas mask to batting practice to protest pollution, calling manager Don Zimmer the gerbil, and running for president on a party whose platform included lowering the boiling point of water. He earned the nickname the Spaceman in the 70s, and it stuck. Lee has a new book with writer Richard Lally about his life after Major League Baseball called Have Glove, Will Travel. In it, Lee explains how he's managed to keep playing for the past 20 years in minor leagues, charity games, senior leagues, and traveling road shows. The journey has taken him throughout the United States, as well as to Canada, Venezuela, Russia, and Cuba. At age 58, Bill Lee is still throwing trick pitches and making mischief on and off the field. One of the things that you tell us in this book is that, I mean, you were a guy who never believed in a no-alcohol, no-drugs training regimen. You enjoyed your time in baseball. And one of the things I found interesting was you said that you often pitched better with a hangover. Why?
Yes. I learned that from Marichal. Marichal always said whenever he was hurt,
Let me just interrupt and remind we're talking about Juan Marichal, the great.
Juan Marichal. You're right. He's the great, the Dominican dandy, and he and I are still close. And I remembered him going out against Drysdale and against Koufax, and he would be sore, and he'd be cranky, and his windup would be flawed, and you know, he'd give up a lot of long foul ball home runs, and then next thing you know, he'd just, all of a sudden, he'd turn it around, and he had pinpoint control, and, you know, he always told me you pitch a lot better, a little better when you're a little hurt and you're a little lame, and I remember the Indians, they always, lame beaver was always a very good distinction. A three-legged beaver is tougher than a four-legged beaver.
Now, why do you pitch better if you're hungover or a little impaired?
I think you don't make mistakes. You realize that you're a little hurt and you can't afford to get cocky. You can't afford to let your ego take over. You've got to make pinpoint pitches. You have to really read the hitter better and know when to subtract and when to come inside. And you just seem to dance better. And it's kind of a – pitching is a sobering thing. I think as you get into the third or fourth inning, all of a sudden you're running on what you call it's a Zen quality where it's Zen mind, beginner's mind. All of a sudden you're throwing the ball even before you release it, and everything seems to fall into place. And I could always get into that state for some reason, and people couldn't believe that I could do what I did with as little as I had. And I think that's a credit that, I've always tried to be a minimalist, and I think I did that when I pitched.
Well, the remarkable thing about that is that a pitcher isn't just playing catch. If he's got runners on base, he has to keep track of each of them. He knows the strengths and weaknesses of the hitters that are against him, the runners on base. He's communicating with a catcher about the selection of the pitch and its location. How is that zen? How is that minimalist? That's a lot to keep track of.
Wow, you don't think about that. My coach said, Tiger, don't think out there. Cut your head off, let your body do the work. I'll do all the thinking. And I think we take it to a level of, I call it a parasympathetic level, where we don't use our head. It's kind of our eyes to our spinal cord, to our fingertips, to our feet, and it's kind of a dance that we get into. And I get into a cardiovascular nature as I work fast. I used to work fast. It drive hitters crazy. You know, Cotton, I, and some of the good ones that could pitch would get control the tempo of a game and get to the end result a lot faster. Hitters would step out on me, and if they stepped out on me, I'd throw at them. You know, I said, get back in the box. You know, I don't intimidate anyone with my fastball, but I would throw it right at their skull and tell them, hey, look at, they're not here to see you step in and out of the batter's box. Hargrove hated me. And Fisk, my catcher, was a notorious malingerer too. And so I tried to get him to speed up the tempo of the game. And umpires like that. Umpires, most umpires, you know, when I got to the National League, they questioned me initially and wanted to see my resolve. But when I didn't complain, when they'd make a bad call, they realized that, you know, we weren't out there to watch them umpire or to watch me pitch. They were out there to watch a ball game and see how it unfolded.
The interesting thing about hearing you describe this sort of cutting your head off, sort of forgetting about all that and just pitching, is that I think I am fascinated by your descriptions in this book of the mechanics of pitching and of baseball. I mean, the precision and kind of poetry of what works and what doesn't. For example, when you said how one game in Venezuela, you were trying to impress somebody and throw too hard. And what you discovered was that in doing that, you were coming down too quickly, screwing up your release point, and so the pitches didn't have the dip that they needed to have, the snap. So while you don't think about it, you certainly analyze it in an interesting way.
Well, Lolly does.
That's your Richard Lolly, your collaborator.
Richard, he's a pitcher wannabe. Likes to be an athlete and a great guy. He and I are, he's a Yankee fan. I'm a Red Sox fan. We've hooked up. Back in the old days when I wrote the wrong stuff, he came to me with a proposal. And I'll tell you, that was a great marriage made in heaven because we both played off of one another. I called it kind of like educating Richard, you know, and I do know. My theory is if I'm backing up third base, I did something wrong, you know, or give the hitter credit that he hit the ball in the gap, made a good pitch, and he went the other way, drove it in the right center field gap, and now I've got to go over and cover third base because he's going to be coming around second into third. But I'll tell you something, as far as analyzing it down to that minutia, I know that if I'm a little high, I overstride it. Shorten your stride. Right. Everything's like tempo. It's the tempo of a golf swing. It's not how hard you swing. Sam Snead, nice, smooth tempo. Bobby Jones, you know, all of them. It wasn't until Palmer started swinging out of his ass that guys started trying to knock the ball down the fairway. And then you had Jack Nicklaus that came out there, and he was a walking rain delay. He used to drive me crazy, and I couldn't stand him. I love Julius Boros. I like guys that got up there, read the line, knocked the putt, walked up there. If they didn't make it, so be it. You know, they never agonized over things like Nicklaus was it's agony and the ecstasy. And
So it's letting the flow of the game happen, staying in rhythm.
Letting the flow of the game happen and having a tempo. That's why I love old-time baseball. I love watching the older games and the guys with the full windups. And these guys are out there, and they play baseball. They never pulled muscles. They never have weight machines. They never did stretching or anything else. They played pepper, they chewed tobacco, and they went out and played baseball. And they had a good time, and the game was over, and they went out and had a couple of brews, went home and did it again. Now you get your Halliburton, you go out with your cell phone, or you talk to your agent, and you go do a couple of commercials, and you do this and that. And I'm going, why would the American public want to know what a ball player ate or what a ball player did, and that's our society that we've created.
Let's talk about the modern game a little bit. I mean, the big controversy now is steroids. There's a lot of controversy because some people think those who take steroids cheated. Did you ever cheat as a ball player, like put sandpaper in your glove or an emery board to play tricks on the ball?
Every chance I could get. Yeah, I tell you, they eliminated, you couldn't chew Slippery Elm anymore, and that was a lot of spitballers threw.
Now explain, is that a brand of tobacco?
Slippery Elm is a throat lozenge that's got elm in it that's highly slippery, and it increases your saliva flow so you can lick your fingers when you're dry at the seventh inning of a ball game and put a foreign substance on the top of the ball. So when you release it, you put a little pine tar on your thumb, first of all, to get more tension on the bottom of the ball and more friction, and then you put Slippery Elm on the top, and then you have a tumbling fastball that you just can't flat out hit. Man, if you can make the ball go down and you can only hit the top half of the ball, first of all, you don't need any outfielders. You can take them and just put them on the bench because it's going to be all infield play, and hitters are going to have to make an adjustment. Most hitters are dumber in the post, so they'll never make that adjustment. So the game's going to be 2-1. And I love sinkers. I love spitballs. I love anything that'll make the ball go downward.
Well, what about those? Then is it okay if hitters cork their bats? And I mean,
oh sure. You know, when you see hitters having to do stuff, it means they're hungover, their bats slowed down, they're starting to worry about things. When guys start corking their bats, it's the beginning of the end, and it's a symptom that they can't hit, and that's why Sosa is not in Chicago anymore. They feel that he's, you know, they're sending him down for the last time and stuff, and I love it when hitters start having to do things or go to a lighter bat because they're getting jammed, and we know that. Pitchers, there's a grapevine out there, and we find out when someone can't hit it, don't worry, it's on the web.
So do you think the league should even have any of these rules, or is it a matter of, well, if you get caught, fair enough?
Heck, they shouldn't. Those rules, the umpires never did it. Gaylord Perry, you couldn't, every ball they threw into the umpire, he couldn't even catch it. It squirted up in his hand like a banana, you know, and they never threw him out of the ball game, and he's in the Hall of Fame. You look at Cap Anson, who was a big racist and everything else, and Ty Cobb, another big racist, and you look at all these people in the Hall of Fame, put them all in the Hall of Fame. They're all crooks.
One more thing about the modern game. I mean, when you played, salaries weren't anything like they are now. And you've got, you know, a system that a lot of people think allows the big market teams like the Yankees to just really compete unfairly, to buy players. Do you think that's unfair? I mean, should the game have rules that make the competition fairer among the different teams?
Well, that's called the National Football League.
Right.
And they have a weak union, and they have a strong ownership group, and they control everything, and every Sunday they put a good product out there on the field, and, you know, that's football. And football is the Monroe Doctrine, where we expansionism from coast to coast, and we take care of everything, and it's all run on a clock, which I really hate. But baseball it's timeless. It goes out. You play it on in beautiful fields when the grass turns green. You don't play it when it rains. It's a civilized game without a clock, and it is, you know, it's our economic system. I'm a anarchist, a socialist. I'm the only communist ever to pitch in the big leagues, and I think that's the whole nature of what we do. Gosh, it drives me nuts.
And it costs $85 to buy an infield ticket at Fenway Park nowadays. I mean, are you disenchanted, or do you still love to watch Major League Baseball?
Oh, gosh, I love baseball. I don't care what level it's played on. I would rather watch a bunch of Cubans for 10 centavos down in Havana smoking a beautiful Cohiba that was hand-rolled by a gentleman right there at the ballpark, drinking a cerveza that cost a nickel, and watching the ball game there for eternity. I would rather go to Cuba and watch a game than watch a game anywhere else.
My guest is Bill Lee. He was a big league pitcher for the Boston Red Sox and the Montreal Expos. His new book is called Have Glove, Will Travel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. We're back with Bill Lee. He is a former big league ball player. His new book about his life after Major League Baseball is called Have Glove, Will Travel. You wrote that Vermont saved your life. Why?
Yeah, well, it did. It took me away from a bar in Vermont, and it took me away from a bar in Montreal. I call my house a halfway house. It's halfway between those two bars. And the funny thing is, I'm a gregarious drinker. I'm not a closet drinker. I'm not the kind of guy that sits around and drinks when there's not a party happening. It's only in my house, there's hardly a party, so I'm pretty sober most of the time.
There's a moment in the book where you are, someone's trying to convert you to religion, and you recognize that he's a reformed drinker, you think. And you write, addicts must replace their addiction with other opiates, be it smoking, bodybuilding, cyber cruising, game shows, gambling, raw sex, anything that can substitute for their habit. So they never truly lose their compulsions. They simply take up more benign ones, like playing baseball 250 days a year. That's obviously you. Is there an addiction you're running from?
Oh, God, no. Not anymore. All of them are the same. I mean, I'm not fearful of anything. You know, the greatest line I think I had, they asked about mandatory drug testing. And I said, you know, I tested them all in the 80s, and I don't think it should be mandatory.
You've tested all of them, right?
Yeah.
You finished the book by talking about your family, your dad, and the way baseball has an enduring appeal and something that's brought you all together and that you've enjoyed together. I mean, you have generations on the diamond. You play father and son games.
Yeah.
Would you want to read a little bit of
just tell you a story.
Tell me a story.
It might not even be in the book. We're playing in the father-son games down in Arizona, and I've got my son Michael hitting behind me and Andy hitting in front of me, and we're down two runs, and I got two men on base, and I fight off this young college pitcher, and he's breaking ball, fastball in, jams me. He hangs a slider and hit a baseball right by his ear, bullet up the middle, and tie up the ball game. I'm at first base. Now my son Michael gets up. My dad's right behind there. This is the 18th inning of a doubleheader in 100-degree heat. Well, it wasn't that hot. It was about 82. And he's standing there with his little hat on, chewing tobacco behind home plate. And Andy, I've had a slight hamstring pull, my right hamstring, because I played a lot of ball and I was beat up pretty bad. And Michael hits the first pitch over the right fielder's head. I think it's a home run, but it's a top spinner, and it's coming back into the park, and it hits right at the base of the fence. I'm off at the crack of the bat because there's two outs. I hit second, and I'm dragging my right leg around, and I hit third, and I'm going to score the winning run, and we're going to go to the championship. And I hit home plate with a winning run. My son gets thrown out at third before I touch home plate, and the run doesn't count, and we end up losing. And I go to my dad, and he's standing behind the screen and going, Dad, I was running as hard as I could. I was running as hard as I could, honest. And he looks at me and goes, yeah, son, in one place. Spits his tobacco juice down on my foot, exactly like Dirty Harry and what was that? One of those Clint Eastwood movies.
Right.
Boy, it was a meaningful thing. Yeah, son, you were running as fast as you can, but in one place. And that's it. That's it. You know, we're a tough family, and that's what keeps us going. And I think that's life. You got to be tough and strong and weather the storm. And that's my father's 84. He's about a 14 handicap, shoots his age all the time, and spits tobacco juice on your shoe, and you take it.
But, you know, I think a lot of Little League dads would say that when my kid goes around the bases and he tries to score, does his best, gives it all he has, and then he doesn't score because a runner's thrown out behind him.
Yeah,
you don't insult him. You say, "Great job! You know, you did the best you could do."
That's what's wrong with our society.
That's what's wrong.
We're so much looking for super gratification and praise. Baseball's a game of failure. Baseball's a game of getting out there and only succeeding some of the time, and that's we give this. I call it gratuitous handshaking and high-fiving. You miss a free throw now, and a guy comes down and shakes your hand in the middle of an NBA game and gives you a high five. And that's it. You got Moss doing all his stuff, answering his cell phone, or one of the guys, and all these guys. Premature celebrating is what's wrong with the sport in America. We got way too much premature celebrating out there, and we got to put an end to it. And that's the whole thing. My dad pointed out to me, it was funny. It's kind of a, he wasn't insulting me. He was just making a statement that was just kind of a double-edged sword, and you've got to take it. That's the problem with us out there. We've model-collied our kids and everything else, I think, way too much, instead of showing them the reality of failure.
Well, Bill Lee, may your slider never lose its snap. Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Never had a slider.
You never had a slider?
No, overhand deuce. I had a cut fastball, and I had a slurve, but sliders are fastball pitchers have sliders. I'm a junker. What I had, I have a changeup that you can't hit to this day, and if I ever get a chance to play against you, we got to tell you, if you don't like softball, play hardball. You only have to play once a week, and you get all the satisfaction you need.
I find my way to Vermont occasionally. Maybe we'll do that. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Former Major League junk ball pitcher Bill Lee. His new book about playing baseball after leaving the big leagues is called Have Glove, Will Travel. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Sam Brigger. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the history of Social Security, from FDR's original concept through the economic and political battles that have shaped it since. We talk with Edward Berkowitz, professor of history and public policy at George Washington University. He's written extensively on the subject. Join us for the next Fresh Air.